Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Ian Buruma, who has a novel, The China Lover. Other books include Murder in Amsterdam, Inventing Japan, and co-author of a book called Occidentalism. Ian Buruma, this is your second novel, but your first in several years, correct?
Yes, I haven't written one since, I think it was 1989 that I wrote the last one.
What prompted you to write a novel, or had this been forming for a while? I want to get into some of the details of it, but the idea of writing a novel for someone who's basically been an essayist.
I had been thinking about it for a while, and this particular book was sort of churning away in my mind for more than 10 years, and I had various false starts and even thought I would write it as nonfiction for a while. But I suppose in some cases the subject and what interests you about the subject and the approach to the subject dictates the form. And I felt that fictional treatment would allow me to do what I wanted and to pursue the subject in the way I wanted, in a way that nonfiction wouldn't have.
I read your book, Occidentalism, after reading China Lover. A lot of the ideas in that book are reflected in China Lover. Ostensibly, China Lover is the story from a distance of an actress, a real actress, who went under several names, including Yoshiko Yamaguchi and Shirley Yamaguchi and Ree Koran. But the ideas in Occidentalism concerning how the East views the West come up very clearly, particularly in the first and the third parts of the book. Before we went on the air, you said that wasn't all that conscious.
No, it wasn't conscious in the sense that I certainly didn't write this novel to write a thesis or to give a history lesson or anything like that. I suppose one could say that what interested me about the historical period, i.e., it's the history of Japan that spans the period from the 1930s to the 1970s, roughly, that attitudes towards the West and things that we wrote about in Occidentalism would come up because it's something that fascinates me. But fiction and nonfiction are very different in that way, in that Occidentalism was very much an essay and sort of an argument, whereas the novel isn't. I think it was Philip Roth who once said that you always have to give the devil the best lines and you want to give the characters depth. One thing that interested me about the characters in the novel is that I try to show how people can lend themselves to the worst possible causes for often very noble reasons.
That's in particular the two Sato characters, the first, the younger, older one at the beginning and the younger one at the end of the book. This is the story of this actress and Japan and views by Japanese over a period of about 50, 60 years. And it's seen kind of through the lens of this one actress who pops up in all the stories in various ways. You became aware of her, I understand, during the 1970s. You saw the movie China Nights?
Yes. China Nights was a film made during the war by a Japanese film studio with Japanese actors. It was set in China, and it was meant to be a propaganda film to show the benevolent intentions of the Japanese in Asia and in China. And even as the Japanese, of course, were running amok and massacring large numbers of Chinese and so on, but the propaganda was that this was all done for idealistic reasons, that it was to liberate Asia and from Western imperialism and so on. And the actress, the character in my book, then known as Li Koran or Li Xianglan in Chinese, was supposed to be a Chinese actress, and she appeared in these films, specializing in roles of Chinese girls who fell in love with brave Japanese sea captains and engineers and soldiers and so on. And it was a secret that she was actually Japanese. And I saw this film when I was a film student in Tokyo and became fascinated by it because although it was propaganda, it was pretty good propaganda. What was so sort of eerie and strange about it is that one knew that the situation in China was terrible at the time. The Japanese occupation was very brutal. And yet there was this sort of idealistic, romantic vision of an exotic China and so on that was presented to the Japanese public at the time, for which I can't think of a European parallel. I mean, when the Germans were invading Russia or Poland, they didn't have romantic movies about Russia or Poland showing what a wonderful place it was and how benevolent the Germans were.
This movie, China Nights, is it available for anybody to see?
On the internet, almost anything is available now. But I saw it at the National Film Archive in Tokyo, and I think it is available on VHS. I'm not sure about DVD.
I've managed to get a a glimpse, actually I rented it yesterday, of House of Bamboo because I wanted to see what she looked like in her one American film. She was in her mid-30s at the time. Stunning looking.
Well, she did two American films. There was House of Bamboo, made by Sam Fuller, in which she plays the Japanese woman who falls in love with Robert Stack, I believe. She did another one called Japanese War Bride. She plays a Japanese woman who marries a GI and then comes back, I think, to Bakersfield or some such place and sort of faces discrimination and all that kind of thing. And she was also on Broadway for a while and had a kind of Hollywood life. I mean, she was squired around by Yul Brynner and knew Charlie Chaplin and wanted to be a Hollywood star.
How did you actually meet her?
She ended her life, although she's still alive, but she ended her career as a politician for the ruling Liberal Democrat Party, the Conservative Party in Japan. And I interviewed her for the first time sometime in the 80s, actually for Interview magazine, which was then edited by a distinguished American editor, now a books editor, called Shelley Wanger, who was Walter Wanger's daughter. And her mother actually acted in Japanese War Bride. I did that piece for her. That's the first time I met her. I interviewed her several times, but never really got a lot out of her because her life in Japan is a legend. And there are several ghosted autobiographies. There are a new movie is coming out next year on her life made by Koreeda. There is a manga about her life. There is a TV soap opera about her life. There was even a musical about her life. And so the last thing she wants to do is sit down with a foreigner and a tape recorder and depart from the record.
And at that time, were you ever considering writing a biography of her?
I was considering it, yes, but in the end that wasn't what interested me most. What interested me really was how people projected their fantasies on her. She was this sort of Lulu-like character, the Lulu in Wedekind's play, who is a kind of blank page on which men project their fantasies, which can be political, they can be erotic, they can be anything. So she's a rather oblique figure in the story. In the end, I think she's the survivor, and these men are not, but it's really about these men more than it is about her. And it seems as though she's this rather sad character who's being manipulated, but actually, although it's not spelt out, she knows how to survive.
There's an interesting moment in House of Bamboo where Robert Stack says, "I have a crick in my neck." And this is not the scene that you describe in China Lover, but the previous scene, she reaches over, and at that moment, the character drops and you see the real her, and she's got a very fierce intelligence.
Yes, I suppose so. And to survive so long, she must be quite intelligent. She's not the conventional beauty. I mean, to Japanese, she's always seemed very exotic looking, not Japanese looking. And so it was easy for her to play Chinese girls. Of course, she grew up in China, so she spoke Chinese. She also played an Aboriginal girl in Taiwan in a movie made during the war, all about the loyalty of these Aboriginal tribes for the benevolent Japanese. In fact, they filmed it in an Aboriginal area, and they needed military guards to keep Aboriginals off their backs who weren't at all friendly.
In the midsection of the book, which is about her movie career in Japan and in America, there's a lot of detail about the making of the film House of Bamboo. Did that come from one of your interviews?
No. Some of that is made up. Of course, I saw the film. I don't think there is an account of the making of it. I got quite a lot of period detail, really, from conversations with a very well-known American critic and writer, Donald Ritchie, who has lived there since the occupation period after World War II and was very much involved in film, Japanese film, although he didn't know Yamaguchi all that well. From talking to him, I did get an idea of what it was like to make films in the 50s and 60s in Japan.
What about the story about her not getting along with Stack and having Ryan chasing after her?
Do you know, what is so interesting is when you do research for a novel and then you fictionalize, you don't really remember anymore what is true and what isn't. I think I did read something about that, but I cannot be sure, so I don't want to leave the false impression.
When I started the interview, I was talking about some of the relationship of the book Occidentalism to the three sections of The China Lover. In a nutshell, Ian Buruma, how do you define the argument of Occidentalism as briefly as you can? I mean, it's a 160-page book, but as briefly as you can, so we can see how it weaves through China Lover.
Well, it's a book that is very commonly misunderstood. We talk about hostile views of the West, but that doesn't mean criticism of Western politics or Western policies or colonialism or capitalism, all of which is entirely legitimate. We're talking about an image of the Western world, of Western civilization, which is so hostile that it wishes to destroy every sort of symbol of that civilization, indeed that civilization itself. It's the view of the suicide bomber, if you like, of 9/11. We try to argue that that very hostile depiction of the West is not peculiar to Islamist suicide bombers, but actually came from the West itself, and that there is a strong anti-Western tradition, a violent anti-Western tradition in the West. And I also describe in that book, and I think that's probably what you mean, how some of these ideas affected Japanese intellectuals and justified the attack on Pearl Harbor and the war against the West in general. And, of course, there is some overlap.
When Sato talks about the Japanese view of creating this great Asian sphere for Manchukuo and completely ignores Nanking, obviously, in anything negative, when he's doing that and talking about Japanese history, I found it fascinating in Occidentalism that the Japan and the Japanese tradition that he's describing as if it goes way back is actually fairly recent and pretty much comes from reading of Western German philosophers.
Yes, I mean, that was true of a lot of nationalist ideas in the 20th century, and certainly when they become racial, because the idea of ethnic nationalism, although there is a bit of that in Chinese history, for example, in rebellion against the Mongols and the Manchus, but it's a relatively modern idea that the nation-state is based on some kind of ethnic notion of a superior race and so on. And these ideas did come from romantic nationalists in Europe, particularly Germany, but they also influenced Russia. And it influenced Japan very strongly.
Do you think it was fairly common in Japan for people to have Sato's view that Manchukuo was this great experiment? It, in a weird way, reminded me of how the neocons viewed Iraq.
Yes, and I think that, again, I didn't spell this out, but I was aware of that when I was writing it. I think there is a parallel in that it was perfectly possible to be idealistic about Manchukuo, about Japan being the liberator of Asia from Western imperialism and Western capitalism and so on, even though it resulted in the murder of millions of people. But it was possible to be an idealist, and many Japanese were, even Japanese leftists. I mean, there were Japanese liberals and leftists involved in Manchukuo because they shared the criticism of Western imperialism and capitalism with right-wing nationalists. Just as it's perfectly possible to be an idealist about the Iraq War, in retrospect it's a bit difficult, but at the time. I think the difference with perhaps Germany is that it's harder to imagine being sort of nobly idealistic about an ideology that won't allow people to have the right to exist and is overtly exterminationist. But that wasn't the case in Manchukuo. And you know, the Japanese had a point. I mean, the Western imperialism was, in many ways, noxious.
Did you ever get a chance, have you ever been to any of the towns of Manchukuo, the cities, since then? And there's one city described particularly, which apparently was mostly built by the Japanese?
Yes, the capital of Manchukuo, the Japanese called Shinkyo, the new capital, now known as Changchun, as it was before the Japanese took it over, is fascinating, and you can see the whole thing still. And it is an experiment in sort of Asian modernism. And the Japanese wanted to build this ideal modern Asian country, and because it was already in an age, the 1930s, that colonialism was suspect, and certainly the Japanese were anti-colonialist, or at least anti-Western colonialism, so they had to pretend that this was an independent state, where of course it wasn't. Everything was kind of fake about it. The whole thing was like a sort of stage set, which is why it's always fascinated me. It's a theatrical thing, and you see, in this new capital, you see these sort of huge, modernist, sort of Bauhaus-type buildings with oriental roofs on top. And this was known as the new Asian style. And the actress in the propaganda films and so on, it's sort of acting out a fantasy of benevolence, of modernity, of Asianness, and so on. And it's that sort of stagey quality of that historical period which fascinated me.
Today, when we look at Manchukuo, when we look at that from this perspective, we see this puppet state. We don't see that they looked at it very differently in Japan. And of course, your characters later on seem to understand that the villains of part one of the book are later seen as heroes because they were the underground.
Yes, that's right. Of course, not all Japanese at the time thought this was a great idea, but enough did to create a certain, even today, a certain nostalgia for it. I mean, nobody is nostalgic for what happened in China. That was very painful. It's a painful memory. Not to everybody. I mean, there's a sort of fairly strong right-wing fringe in Japan that still pretends that nothing bad happened. But most Japanese are embarrassed about what happened in China. But Manchukuo is still seen with a certain fondness for a great dream that unfortunately went wrong.
You're listening to an interview with Ian Buruma, whose latest novel is The China Lover. You intersperse real characters, real people. Amakasu, who is the head of Manchurian propaganda, a gangster whose name I can't pronounce, was he also real?
Well, he's based on somebody who was real. In fact, he's based on several people who are real. One of them was a man called Sasakawa, who became quite famous all over the world. He was a fascist in the 1930s, and there's a famous photograph where he shakes hands with Mussolini. And during the war, he was a sort of fixer in China who got into all kinds of shady business. And he was a kind of gangster. And then after the war, because he'd made so much money during the war, he was a sort of sponsor of the far right and the right wing of the ruling party. But he also had a motorboat association for gambling, so he made even more money. And like all gangsters who want to go legit or want to seem legit, he donated a lot of money to all kinds of places, and he became the biggest individual donor to the United Nations, for example. And his great ambition after the war was to win the Nobel Peace Prize, something that fortunately never happened. But that villainous character is partly based on him.
And the research into Manchukuo, there's a lot of books on it then?
There are a lot of books on Manchukuo, yes. Quite a lot of interesting sort of travel accounts by Westerners at the time in the 30s who often admired it. Ian Fleming, the creator of James Bond, his brother, Peter Fleming, wrote several travel books about Northeast Asia. He describes, you know, how suddenly the trains ran on time and everything was clean and orderly and so on in the cities. I mean, the countryside the Japanese never rarely controlled, and so it was dangerous. But a lot of Europeans who went there admired it. I mean, they had the fastest trains in the world. Everything had to be sort of the latest technology was applied there. In some ways, it was an impressive place, if rather oppressive as well.
One thread that runs throughout the book, it starts there and I was a little taken aback, but it grows through the book, is something I didn't really know about, which was Japanese anti-Semitism.
Yes, well, the history of Japanese anti-Semitism is quite interesting. I mean, in the first part of the book, which is about the Japanese occupation of northeastern China, Manchukuo, there's a description of a dinner in Harbin, which had a large Russian Jewish community who'd fled the Russian Revolution. And it's a dinner to celebrate the Japanese-Jewish friendship. And this really happened. And the Japanese did protect the Jews in Harbin. And these dinners did take place, much to the chagrin of the rabbi in Shanghai, who was in a different situation and felt that they shouldn't be palling around with an Axis power. The reason why the Japanese protected the Jews in Shanghai and Harbin during the war, despite German attempts to get them to either hand them over or arrest them, was in itself a form of anti-Semitism, which was that the Japanese believed that the Jews ruled the world. And they believed it because they'd fought Russia in 1905, and Russian POWs gave them the Protocols of the Elders of Zion to read. And Japan had managed to win the war and stay economically afloat because a banker in New York called Jacob Schiff, who was born in Russia and had no love for the Russians, helped the Japanese. And so they put two and two together. They thought, Jacob Schiff, money, Elders of Zion, they run the world, so we better make sure that they stay on our side.
You talk in Occidentalism that the idea that the Jews are the leading communists and the leading capitalists may sound to us as a bit contradictory, that they're ruling the world from both ends, but that didn't seem to bother the Japanese too much.
No, but of course it seems a contradiction. In the mind of an anti-Semite, it's not necessarily contradictory, because both capitalism and communism are sort of universalist ideas that are not rooted in one particular ethnic or national community. It's a sort of, it is a worldwide system. or it aspires to be, which is, of course, why it attracted quite a lot of Jews, because nothing that stresses sort of local ethnic chauvinism is going to be good for a minority. You still hear all kinds of strange conspiracy theories about the Jews in Japan, even though there are, of course, no Japanese Jews. Some of these things that I describe really did happen in history. For example, General MacArthur, who ran the occupation, the Allied occupation of Japan after World War II, had an administration that was split between liberal New Dealers and very right-wing people who were mostly in his intelligence units. And the head of that was a man called Willoughby, who was a John Bircher, in fact, and virulently anti-Semitic, and had sort of portraits of General Franco on his desk and so on. I mean, it's odd to think a figure like that being powerful in the American administration of Japan, but you know, there it was.
And that takes us into part two of the book, because he's a character. The main character in part two is an American from the Midwest named Vanoven, who is gay. Why did you make him gay?
I think because a lot of people who were attracted to Japan and wanted to live there saw it as a liberating place where they could live the kind of lives that they couldn't have done in those days, in certainly not in small town Ohio. I've known several of these people who fell in love with Japan for that reason, partly because as a foreigner in Japan you're sort of exempt from everybody else's social rules, but partly because there is a lack of the kind of puritanism that the Christian West still had. And so many Americans and Europeans saw Japan as a form of liberation, and which of course again is partly based on fantasies, and since the novel is a story of fantasies, I wanted that to be one of them.
And the other element of fantasy, which again stretches mostly in that section but back through the other sections, is the relation of Hollywood and film to the actual lives of the people in the book.
That's correct, yeah. Now, all three narrators, all three men, are film buffs. The problem with them is that they kind of mistake movie reality for reality. Again, it was something that's fascinated me since I saw her film, China Nights, for the first time at the Film Archive in Tokyo. I used to go there a lot as a student. And there is something about movie buffs that's a little different from, say, dance buffs or music buffs, in that you're in the dark leading somebody else's life vicariously. And there is something slightly creepy about film buffs. And I remember in the first row, there were about five or six men, and they were there for every single performance, and they looked sort of strange, and the whole conversation was about scenes in movies. I asked, in fact, Donald Ritchie, who had been the curator of the film department of MoMA in New York in the 1960s, I told him about this, and he said, yeah, you find those people in every film archive. They're always there.
In post-war Japan, between 45 and 50, you seem to hint that the area called Asakusa was just almost completely filled with movie theaters.
Not so much in post-war Japan. It was in the 20s and 30s.
Okay.
Yeah, then it was the center of sort of traditional as well as modern entertainment. But Asakusa was in the so-called low city of Tokyo, meaning that it was poor, relatively. And they really got completely obliterated in the bombings in the end of 1944 and beginning of 1945, and nothing remained. I mean, what you see there now is all new.
In terms of, like, looking at what it was like in the 50s, I guess a film like House of Bamboo, really, it's filmed there, so you can kind of see it. It's so different from the Tokyo of now.
Yes. No, and that's one of the interests of that film, of course. The shots outside, the location shots, are fairly realistic. The scenes that take place inside are not. And one of the things that Shirley Yamaguchi told me was how annoyed she was with Sam Fuller, that when she pointed out that the Japanese room that she was in was supposed to be a Japanese room but looked like some sort of Chinese restaurant, and he wouldn't listen to her.
Why did you give Truman Capote a cameo?
Well, that's based on a real account.
Really?
Yeah. He was there to do a piece for The New Yorker on Marlon Brando, in Kyoto, in fact. But I found the story so compelling that I wanted to put it in.
Part three concerns a character named Sato again. And why did you choose the same name?
Because I wanted to show that he could have been the son of the first Sato. I mean, in fact, you don't know whether he is or he isn't. It's a mystery. I wrote it, and even I don't know. But he could have been.
And he becomes a radical. There's a section toward the end of part two where Vanavan begins seeing the radicals who have finally gotten fed up with the United States taking over their country in terms of both culture and politics and, I guess, commerce as well. And they're rebelling in the 60s. And he's a little bit later. He's in the late 60s, early 70s, our generation. Mm-hmm. He winds up becoming a Palestinian guerrilla, which brings us back to the Islamist side. Had you always intended for that to be part of it?
Yes, but not because of the current interest in Islamism or anything like that. I was always very interested in these people because, like the German extremists, the extreme left of the 70s, who were also trained in Palestinian camps and so on, they ended up doing something rather similar to their fathers, i.e. fighting Israel, of course, but falling into the trap of violent extremism. But they did it perversely, often as a kind of rebellion and a reaction to what their fathers had done. And so the idea in the 60s in Germany and in Japan was our fathers, you know, did all these terrible things during the war, or they looked the other way and did nothing and so on. This will not happen to us. We will, you know, resist and resist fascism and so on. Ended up doing something that was just as violent. In a way, Shirley Yamaguchi kind of did the same thing. I mean, she never promoted violence or let alone did anything violent. But, and this is described in the third part, after she retired as a movie actress, she had a television show in Japan aimed at housewives and about current affairs. And she felt that because she'd been on the wrong side during the war, she'd promoted the wrong cause, i.e. the Japanese cause in China, now she would always be on the side of the underdog. And so she made a point of interviewing third world leaders, but in a rather warm and sympathetic manner. But who were these leaders? They were people like Idi Amin and Kim Il-sung and so on, who were pretty nasty. Again, it's an example of somebody who has noble intentions but ends up backing the wrong horse.
There's a point in Occidentalism where you talk about who some of these people are, these suicide bombers, and it turns out they're all intellectuals, people involved in film, and so that brought to my mind the connection between Muhammad Atta and Sato here.
Yes, political extremists, of course, almost always are intellectuals. They're not very poor people who do things out of desperation, even though some people have us believe that that's the case. I mean, some of the people who are used as fodder might be poor people, but the people who, the thinkers behind political terror are almost always educated. You're right. I mean, the Red Army faction people in both in Germany and in Japan were students from the best universities often, middle class. Well, they rebelled in a particularly extreme manner, partly because the legitimate left had sort of lost, and so the children end up devouring one another.
In Occidentalism, you delineate these different strains in the East and how they relate to the West, particularly their view toward liberalism, which again comes back to, you know, these people in the book, particularly in the third part, where he sounds like a liberal and yet he's against Western liberalism. And I'm just wondering, what is the difference between the Islamist or the radical Japanese person looking toward the West and liberal society and cities that you talk about in Occidentalism and Sarah Palin?
Well, there is a difference in that they may all have sort of moral and political objections to Western liberalism, but they don't all seek to destroy it or bomb it. I'm no fan of Sarah Palin, but don't assume that that's her program. Again, one has to be very careful to distinguish people who, for very good reasons, have great problems with Western policies, politics, economics, and so on, Western style, one has to say, and bombers. Noam Chomsky is very critical of American policy and so on, but he doesn't want to destroy anything. So I think there is a big difference there.
When you're writing a book like China Lover, Ian Buruma, and you're doing your research, What changes in you as you do the research and write the novel?
I don't know if anything changes. One difference between writing fiction and nonfiction, I found, is that in the case of fiction, your own memories play a big role. Things you hadn't really thought about consciously suddenly emerge and find a place in the story, not necessarily by putting them in exactly as you remember your own life, but somehow you use your own life, things you remember, things people have said, and so on. And it makes you a bit more conscious of yourself, perhaps, but I don't think it changes you profoundly.
You worked in film. You're a documentary filmmaker, and you also acted, and a lot of that was in Japan?
Yes.
And that plays a role,
absolutely,
I guess, in the subtext.
No, absolutely.
Here.
I mean, none of it is completely autobiographical, but certain things in my life have found a place in the story. That's certainly true, and usually in a distorted manner. For sure. And I think in most fictions, there'll be a little bit of the author in most of the characters without any of the characters being really like the author.
Were the scenes of Vanavan and the Japanese and how they viewed him as a Westerner, were those things that happened to you as well?
Well, either happened to me or I heard people talk about life in that sort of way. And again, it's not just memories of yourself, but memories of people you've known.
Well, what do you think of Japan now? I mean, the book ends in the early 70s,
yeah.
73. I mean, there's a little carryover. It's written in the late 80s or early 90s.
Ironically, it ends pretty much at the point that I actually went to Japan for the first time. When I lived in Japan in the 70s, first as a student and then as a journalist, the sort of raffishness and excitement of the post-war, the early post-war period, was still there. It was still visible. You could also still see sort of veterans playing the accordion in front of subway stations, you know, who'd lost their limbs and that kind of thing. But there was a kind of rough edge to it, and that has been pretty much polished off. I mean, Japan today is very slick compared to the Japan that I knew, and in some ways I regret that. I mean, I think what attracted me to the place is no longer quite so evident.
There's one moment in House of Bamboo where characters are standing right outside the moat of the Imperial Palace, and suddenly I'm going, oh, I know, I was there. But the other scenes of Tokyo, I looked at them and yeah, they bore a certain resemblance to Tokyo of Godzilla, but nothing to the Tokyo of 2005 when I was there.
No, that's true. It's now a very, very slick place. And you know, maybe for most people who live there, much more comfortable. But there was something about the 70s, 60s, and 70s still that was exciting.
When was the last time you saw Yoshiko Yamaguchi?
Actually, the last time I spoke to her was a few days after 9/11. I spoke to her on the phone, and she said to me, yep, it's a funny old world.
And she's still alive. She's
still
pushing,
alive.
She's what, 88 now?
Must be pushing 90, yes.
The last time you saw her, do you see still little glimpses of the China Nights?
Oh, yes, and she breaks into Chinese all the time in conversation.
Really?
So, absolutely, yeah. And she's still a striking-looking old lady.
Why did you call the book The China Lover?
I suppose because it refers to the first character and to her. I think she genuinely does love China. So all the contradictions in her life, being on the side of Japanese propaganda that did so much damage in China and so on, I think these tensions really were painful to her. And she did have a lifelong love affair with the country of her birth.
Ian Buruma, now we're in fall of 2008. What do you think, now that we know that the Bush policies, the war on terror, just didn't work and it was a bad idea, made a few people a lot of money, in a new administration, what direction do you think they should go in to ease Occidentalism, both in the Far East and places like Japan as well as in the Middle East?
Well, it'll be very difficult. I suppose, well, going to war for ideological reasons in the Middle East is not a good idea, as we know. I think the great dilemma is that one of the things that spurred violent Islamism in the Middle East was not the United States. It was the fact that the Middle East is run by secular dictators largely, and it's an extreme religious based rebellion against these secular police states, and they're very corrupt police states. The corruption is associated with the West. And also the West, the United States, supports a lot of these regimes, not because they necessarily like them, but because they're afraid that the alternative might be worse, which is that in elections you might get an Islamist government. And I think there's a real problem, because as long as we support these police states, it's going to inflame anti-Western feeling amongst those who rebel against them. But does that mean that we should simply drop our support even if Islamists take over? It's not that easy. I think if we're serious about democracy, then we have to listen to what the people there say and want. And if they elect a religious party, then you live with that.
That was, to me, the ultimate irony of Iraq, is that we got rid of a stalwart who was against both the Wahhabis and the Shiites in Iran, and instead we wind up with a pro-Iranian government that we have to support.
That's right. But, I mean, Obama has been criticized by his opponents for saying that he is prepared to talk to people even when they're on the other side. But I think, in principle, that he's right, that short of bombing countries, it is better to talk to people, especially if they've been elected. And that goes for Hamas and it goes for the Iranians. And talking doesn't necessarily solve problems, but it's a start.
Ian Baruma, you've written The China Lover. Your previous book was about the murder of a filmmaker in Amsterdam. And again, ties in because it deals with the issues of that you talk about in Occidentalism. Where are you going from here? What are you working on now?
I'm doing a little book based on a series of lectures on religion and democracy.
That's No Divine Right? Religion and Democracy in Three Continents. It's a series of three lectures you're giving.
At Princeton.
Do you ever plan to get back into film?
Well, I'd love to, in a way, but I mean, you can't do everything. The reason I didn't pursue a career in film was that I don't have the patience for it. You have to be very, very, it's a bit like being an architect. You have to really be prepared to wait for the money to come through and so on, and also live with big projects that at the last minute never happen. And I'm too impatient for it. I like the idea of writing, that you can just sit down and it depends on no one but yourself.
You've been listening to an interview with Ian Baruma, whose latest novel is The China Lover. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.